Welcome to Valley Voices. I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, your host. Today's show features clips from the final Grizzly Creek Fire Facebook community meeting and update, plus a look back at some of the KDNK News team's coverage of firefighting and fire management from inside the fire perimeter. The Grizzly Creek Fire remains at 32,464 acres and 91% containment. The clips from the final update begin with White River National Forest Supervisor Scott Fitzwilliams.
Next phase, it's kind of cleanup time for this fire. There's still, believe it or not, these fires won't necessarily go out. You will be quite amazed that when it dries out in a few days that there's going to be a hot spot here and there. So there's that. But I think one of the main questions we'll have, and I promise everyone, especially for the hunters out there, that we are going to work very hard to get, we'll probably start with Coffee Pot Road. That'll be the first one we'll be able to open. It's going to be a couple days, but I'm really hopeful we can get that open for maybe even before the muzzleloader season that starts Saturday. But we're working at it. I have to get the go-ahead from the team and the operations people before we can do that. But I promise that that's a high priority. I realize that's a big chunk of national forest that people want to access, and especially those who've had tags and things like that. So, so we're going to work on that. Transfer trail is another question that comes up a lot. It's going to be a little longer. There's quite a bit of heavy equipment up there. I can't give you a date yet, but it's probably going to be a week, maybe a little more. But we still have, there's quite a bit of heavy equipment up there that needs to get out of there before we can let the public in there and safely. As I close here and take questions, gratitude to this team, to this community. We're really lucky with this weather that's hit Colorado. And I look to the west, and this front did not hit Washington, Oregon, California. And they have their hands full right now, like many people have never seen. So let's be grateful to that and keep those folks in our thoughts, because they got some work ahead of them. And fire season in California is just starting, if you can imagine. And so some pretty devastating effects. So we'll move on and take any questions that people might have.
Okay, Cale, what questions have we received here on Facebook?
Well, the audience online is still very engaged, which is great. So let's start with Scott and David for the incoming team. Will the Type 3 team be able to get the same resources and attention that your Type 1 team got? A lot of curiosity around that change.
Sure.
From 1 to 3 and what that means.
Yeah. Well, as John mentioned, it's a significant reduction. We adjust the size of the organization towards based on the needs and what's going on with fire behavior. And right now, weather has been kind to us. So that said, if we have a problem, we will call and we'll get resources. Now, as I mentioned with California, Washington, Oregon, they're going to be a higher priority than a fire that just got a foot and a half of snow on it. But it's not like we abandon and walk away. We're going to pay attention, and as we need resources, we'll call for them. And I think there's enough resources in the state now that things are calmed down that we'll get them if we need them.
And along those lines, we'll just keep rolling with it. Folks were asking, will we still have initial attack resources around?
Oh yeah, absolutely. All the UCR resources from the Forest Service BLM that are manages this area, they're all here, and so we have both ground and air resources available for initial attack. Great question.
Okay, great. Thank you. And let's get into cost. That's always interesting at this part of the fire. Are there any hard numbers as to the dollar cost associated with the fire to date?
Yeah, as of yesterday, I think it was about $32 million. Expensive. I haven't looked at the breakdown. I can take a look at it. But, those first 10 days, it was about $8 million in aircraft, because that was the primary way to fight it, and it's expensive. And then once we, establish camps and crews, it's an expensive. This will undoubtedly, it's the largest fire in White River National Forest history. It's also for sure the most expensive. And it's just firefighting's expensive, and the resources we were, charged to protect were a lot more expensive.
So can I take a crack at some of that there, Cale?
You bet. Go ahead, Incident Commander.
Okay, so Scott was saying, firefighting is very labor-intensive and can be expensive, especially when we're going at it hard initially. I think some of the figures from this fire is $1.2 million a day, something like that, when we're using aircraft and we're gearing up logistically to try and support all that. Intensive firefighting in California, and one incident I was on is almost $2.5 million a day. Those are all big figures here, but let's talk a little bit about how we got there. You know, original firefighting was in the forest. We were forest rangers, that sort of thing, back in the 20th century when I first started. And a lot of that was protect timber and trees and those sort of things. Now, firefighting today has a completely different spin to it, and it's all talked about in the wildland-urban interface. And that's because people have built into the urban interface where we're butting up against recreational areas and public land and that sort of thing, and that's all a good thing as people seek more space there. But it presents a certain amount of problems for us because we're no longer protecting timber, really. We're protecting public interest in infrastructure, homes, values at risk, all that related thing. So if you look at this fire, and what we did was draw a 5-mile perimeter around the fire, and then we took the values in there. So on our east side, towards the Eagle area, just in that 5-mile perimeter, we're looking at over $100 million of values that we're protecting. Over on the west side in the Glenwood Springs area, we're looking at about $2.5 billion of values that we're protecting there. So when you start to compare that, that's where you're getting your value. You know, public entities are under intense scrutiny to perform. And so that's our performance measure that we're looking at. If you just look down the highway corridor, as CDOT will tell you, what we're told is $1 million an hour in economic loss when that thing is shut down. And so those are the numbers we're dealing with nowadays. And so it's all big dollar amounts, but it's a big dollar that you're protecting in the urban interface environment that we find ourselves in all the time.
Do the costs of the fire suppression still come out of the Forest Service or BLM operating program budgets, or are they not tagged from the forest where the fire happens?
Now we're starting this year, what we called the fire borrowing fix was implemented as passed by Congress last year, and it started this year. So no longer now Congress appropriates a certain amount of money, and if we exceed that, it used to be if on that annually if we exceed that amount of money, and firefighting, it was a bad fire year, they'd start taking out of our regular program dollars. So that fix has been made. Thank you very much, Congress, for doing that because it was really disruptive. This would be the time of year we'd be scrubbing our books and sending all the money to fight fires. So we no longer have to do that, and they do a more accurate, better update. Plus, you know, fire funding was appropriated based on historical numbers, and as Tom was saying before, we're seeing this is our new reality. The cost of this, the intensity of these fires, Colorado's going to have the largest and maybe third largest, fourth largest fire in the same year. We're having the biggest fire ever on this forest. The Arapahoe Roosevelt's having the biggest ever on that forest. There are fires that are doing things no one's ever seen in California and Oregon right now. This is our new reality. This is what, you know, a warming climate does. And so we're fortunate now, to long answer to, that we no longer have to take that out of our local budget anymore.
Great. Thanks. I know that'll come as welcome news. What is the risk to the Glenwood Springs water intake at Grizzly Creek and No Name Creeks now that it's raining and snowing? And is there any risk to the homes in No Name to flood or landslide?
What we can tell you is there is a risk in both to both of those. The water system, I mean, the folks at Glenwood Springs are very concerned about, you know, how much sedimentation could get into that intake system and muck things up pretty well. And then the no-name, same thing. You remove this amount of vegetation from the landscape, things move at a lot faster pace. And so we'll get a little better idea from David and the Bear team, from David and the Bear team, about where those risks are, some validation of how, you know, what is the likelihood or where the severity might be. But, you know, these are big landscapes and it's nature, and we can't give exact percentage or, you know, how big a slide might be. But we're going to monitor it, and I think as the Bear team does a little bit more of their work, we'll get a little bit better data, and hopefully that'll help. And we're going to be, as Dave mentioned, we're going to be sharing whatever information the Bear team comes up with both the City of Glenwood Springs and CDOT, so they can, you know, do some calibrating on what it all might mean.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. And David, on the note of information flow, I know there's a few questions about the Type 3 team. Will the Type 3 team continue to do updates?
We will continue to do updates. We'll definitely be updating NCWEB and Facebook. The written updates that come out, we might start moving those to about every other day. But if you know you need information, then hit NCWEB or the Facebook. And then, you know, if things change, you know, a lot of times when we get to this point, the acreage is staying the same, the containment staying the same. But if we do get some changes, we'll definitely get word out.
Great. So you're definitely keeping an information presence here. So folks at home, I know you've had two Type 1 teams in here with lots of folks who like to deliver lots of videos. And on that note, we do have the newly established Grizzly Creek Fire CO 2020 YouTube page. It has all 104 videos that have been posted on Facebook since day one in chronological order. Connected is 8 or 10 different playlists, including your hero, Jeff Sherber. So that is now with you to be watched.
Well, and that will be awesome. So we definitely appreciate that.
So all the videos are cross-linked. So somebody asked online earlier, where can we watch the old community meetings? Now there's two places. There's the Facebook and the YouTube.
You're listening to Valley Voices and a special Grizzly Creek Fire recap. Next up, a look back at some of KDNK's news coverage of firefighting and fire management from inside the fire. In mid-August, the Great Basin team, Public Information Officer Tom Story, escorted reporter Kathleen Shannon and me into the west end of Glenwood Canyon for a look at what had burned and what hadn't, plus ongoing firefighting work. Here's that story.
Oh, man, it's like right overhead, Amy.
There were a lot of sounds like this in Glenwood Canyon when the KDNK news team was escorted through the western end of it on Wednesday, August 18th, 1 week after the Grizzly Creek fire ignited along I-70. The cause of the fire is still unknown.
We head to the Grizzly Creek Fire Information Center in the Hotel Colorado, pull on our fire outfits, and climb into an official fire car.
1.0104.
With our tour guide.
My name is Tom Story, common spelling Story. I am a public information officer with the incident management team in charge of running the Grizzly Creek Fire.
With the car's flashers on and with the wave of a police officer, we begin our voyage into the canyon.
The smoke is thick, but we don't immediately cross a threshold from green and verdant to an apocalyptic scene of skeleton trees and ash. Instead, the fire makes itself known by what is missing. Traffic on Interstate 70, tourists at the rest areas, cyclists on the bike trail, boaters on the river, and residents at No Name.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, my God, it's No Name. Is it still there?
No Name is still here. Okay. Living up to its name.
No Name looks basically the same, except for fire crews and trucks at the No Name Lane entrance. A sprinkler wets down the front yard of a home. It could have been set by the homeowner as a Hail Mary before fleeing the fire, or by a fire crew to protect the house.
No animals, no pets, no neighbors. Yeah, it's a little sci-fi out here, but there's way less damage than we thought. In fact, No Name appears to be intact.
The main sites are aircraft and wildland firefighters staged along the road. Story tells us that some helicopters are working with XL Energy, restoring power lines in the canyon, but most of them are delicately dipping 700-gallon buckets into a vat of fire retardant at the temporary batch plant near No Name. I-70 is bathed in that neon pink retardant color. Mailboxes nearby are splattered with it. Two huge red tanks sit in the road.
This batch plant makes all of the retardant used on the Grizzly Creek fire.
Okay, retardant is a mixture of water, fertilizer, red iron oxide, a couple other little chemicals for anti-corrosion, and gum arabic to make it sticky. It is there to slow the fire's spread. It is called retardant.
The helicopter veers off, and we make our way deeper into the canyon along the empty highway toward Shoshone Power Plant.
To check out the pumpkin.
If we look down here on the ramp, there is a Mark III pump set up. And the black hose will draw water out of the river, pump it up this hose into the pumpkin, and keep that filled as a reservoir. Then the other Mark III pump is there to supply the fire hoses, which are laid out into the Shoshone Power Plant.
Lots of smoke here, but the riparian area is green and intact, as it appears to be all along the river.
Except where the fire jumped the highway.
Yeah, except for that.
And here we are at Hanging Lake.
At the Hanging Lake parking lot, we see small patches of active burning up in the canyons, hot spots left over from the big flames.
We follow the path to the trailhead, where strips of scorched grass lie cheek by jowl with the concrete pathway, burnt on the north side, green on the south to the river. A checkerboard, or...
In the term of art and fire, it's called a mosaic burn.
Okay.
Where fire moves through areas and burn at different intensities, some removing everything, some sparing some things, and some damaging some things.
Tom Story points out a burned tree that recently collapsed into the parking lot.
Please be extremely careful. If you start hearing a creaking and a snapping and a popping,
get out.
Yes, because the tree is...
Fire changes the soil, he says, and creates hidden hazards.
Like trees that fall over without warning, or rocks rolling and crashing down steep canyon walls.
Speaking of rock falls...
If you look up on the side of the cliff, just at the last tree line, there is a very light-colored area. It was described to us by somebody who saw it as a rock the size of a Volkswagen Beetle came down. It cleared the catch nets, hit the westbound lane, bounced, and took out the guardrail before it ended up in the water and leaving rocks strewn all across all lanes of the highway.
Rock pieces the size of backpacks litter the highway west of the Hanging Lake exit, and the guardrail still hasn't been replaced.
We steer clear and head towards Glenwood, catching a hopeful view of the river.
Boy, that riparian area survived.
Yeah.
It survived.
Yes. Ugh. And although there will be mudslide issues, the ash returns nutrients to the soil, so there's going to be tremendous growth of the fine grasses and stuff. It'll be like an elk and deer cafeteria all through the burns.
For KDNK News, I'm Kathleen Shannon.
And I'm Amy Haddon Marsh, reporting from the Glenwood Canyon. And finally, reporter Lucas Turner went into the Bear Ranch area, which was hit hard by the fire early on. Firefighters were able to save the structures. Here's his story about fire management.
It's Monday morning on the north end of the Roaring Fork Valley in Glenwood Springs. One could hardly describe it as a normal day, with plumes of smoke rising from above Glenwood Canyon to the east and more smoke trailing in from the west. But at least temporarily, some semblance of normalcy has returned to the valley, with I-70 opening up to traffic early in the morning. By nightfall, it will be closed again, but for the moment, some traffic is making its way through Glenwood Canyon. That's where I'll be going, but unlike people in the other vehicles on the highway, I don't come out on the other side of the canyon because a few fellow reporters and I are on our way to active firefighting operations on Bear Ranch, along with our guide, Wayne Patterson, a public information officer for the Federal Incident Management Team in charge of the Grizzly Creek Fire.
The areas that are still had really active fire in them yesterday were up towards the top of Grizzly Creek and the top of No Name. The fire actually came out of the top of No Name onto what they're calling the Silver Cabin area, up there by Silver Cabin and Brown Cabin. And then the area that we're going to, Bear Ranch, has been really active, stayed really active late into the evening yesterday.
We're lucky to have Patterson as our assigned PIO for the day, as he offers an interesting perspective to firefighting, having served as a hotshot in the late 70s. As we drive up a fairly steep mountain road in Bear Ranch, Patterson chats about some of his own firefighting experience, noting that he's served in more ways than one.
My worst one as a human resource specialist was in California, and my worst one as a hotshot was in California. Those are ones that just so easy to get into trouble down there.
He'll share more relevant perspectives over the course of the day as we observe the next generation of wildland firefighters, divided into hotshot crews, drone operators, logistical support, safety managers, and even more public information officers, all working together to fight the Grizzly Creek fire. No matter how you look at it, operations on these kinds of fires are a massive undertaking. But crews on scene are no stranger to the unique rigors of the job.
Everybody knows their roles and responsibilities, and if you do them correctly, it allows for us to operate effectively. So
that's Kelly Boyd, leader of the UNIWEAP Wildland Fire Module out of Grand Junction.
A good ICS system is a good operation, and it allows you to expand and contract as needed. So over the course of the month, you'll see an influx of people, and then you might see a decrease, but the ICS, the Incident Command System, is always there.
We're speaking to Boyd on the top of a ridge with a wide view. Glenwood Canyon sits to the south, and to the north of our location, active burnout or firing operations are taking place. Kelly Boyd's role in the operations sounds almost like science fiction. He's piloting an unmanned aircraft system, commonly referred to as a drone.
You know, this allows us to get in steep, rocky terrain really efficiently. So it's a low-risk, cost-efficient way to get fire, establish fire, in a way that we can protect the timber.
This particular UAS drops incendiary devices called Dragon Balls onto precise locations. The devices exist for a single purpose, to fight fire with fire.
Fire doesn't always burn in a way that's going to be effective for the ecosystem and for the firefighters to control. So we'll get what we'll call fingers or a leg that kind of grows a little farther out than what we want. And so laying some fire down, and we use a term called squaring it up, we like straight lines, allows for us to attack better and be more defensive and more proactive, as keeping it in a box as opposed to a figurine map.
While Boyd is from the surrounding area, he's just one of over 800 personnel from all over the country actively fighting the fire. That includes one of the key leaders, John Kennedy, Operations Section Chief. He explains what the major priorities have been for this portion of the fire.
And we still have a structure throughout. There's some more cabins out to the southeast here. And then over the ridge system here into the Spring Valley Ranch, structures everywhere, infrastructure. We have a major substation over there that supplies Glenwood, Spring Valley. It goes all the way out to Leadville, Colorado.
On a national level, the Grizzly Creek fire quickly reached the highest priority in the nation for federal resources. Kennedy explains why.
It was a high-complexity fire because of the communities and the terrain and the burning conditions and everything else. So, yeah, it was elevated really quick. You know, the sooner you can get in a high-complexity incident, a Type 1 team, a national team, the better.
That priority elevation is nothing to balk at, with the sheer number of fires burning around the country, stretching local and federal resources thin.
Yesterday, there were 2,279 outstanding orders for single resource people like John and I, the people that come out alone, not as part of a crew or an engine.
Yeah.
Even though hotshot crews and other personnel come from all over, Kennedy says they all take a personal stake in their work.
Every firefighter out there treats it like it's their own. It's their family, it's their house, it's their property, it's their livelihood. So, you know, and that leads to the ownership. You know, they own that piece of ground and they want to do the best thing they can do for these people. So it's a very positive experience out here.
For KDNK News, I'm Lucas Turner.
Thanks for listening to Valley Voices and a special look back at the Grizzly Creek fire, which is not completely contained yet. KDNK will continue to provide updates. KDNK is in the midst of our 2020 fall membership drive. Give us a call at 963-0139 or donate online at kdnk.org. Thank you.